Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Heather Digby Parton will join us to discuss the Democratic National Convention and some of the other top news stories from this week. And next week, I'll be on vacation, but Farron Cousins from the Ring of Fire YouTube channel will be filling in with some great interviews and analysis. And if you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the program. You can help us out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. Now, here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from the blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, this has been, we're on day two of the convention, I should say, really, day three starts momentarily. We're taping this a little bit early this week. First 2 days, I think, let's just take this in order, right? I mean, we've got production value. Maybe we should even start with something even more basic. The point of the convention, right? I mean, in most years, or most every 4 years, the convention serves multiple purposes. One is obviously to choose a nominee. Another is for convention goers to go and to build and strengthen networks, whether that's, you know, folks like you and I, maybe meeting other political commentators and activists and whatnot. When I go, I get to interview some union leaders and all sorts of different folks. But for the lobbyists and the big money, they go to woo politicians and develop relationships like that. And then the other function of a convention is to help the nominee win the election. In this instance, really, function number one and two are sort of moot. Obviously, people aren't going to Milwaukee, Wisconsin to meet and network, et cetera, et cetera. The nominee was all but settled, except for some of the formalities. And so it really breaks down to what comes out of the convention will convince more people to vote for the nominee than without the convention. And there's really two different ways you can go there. One is to motivate the base and get them supercharged up to go out and elect this person. And the other is to do a maybe we can persuade people to vote for, in this instance, Joe Biden. The Democrats clearly went with number two in this instance, at least up to this point. I don't see how that's going to change a little bit. I mean, there's been a lot of outreach to John Kasich style Republicans, I guess.
Well, I think I think that you're right about what the point of these conventions are, and I would suggest that they really haven't. The first part where you do the networking and the activists get together and the party has a party, basically, that part obviously was moot this time because of the pandemic. But the second part, I'm not sure that it ever really. I'm not sure it's done that in a long, long time. I mean, the way that these conventions are covered for most of America, if you're there, it's a whole different thing. But if you're watching on TV, mostly what you're watching is talking heads and some interviews with politicians. And if you're not a news junkie, this is pretty, dull stuff. You're not actually seeing anything but a bunch of people talking about the same stuff they're always talking about, and then you get to see some speeches. And those can be moving in the sense that you see somebody make a big grand speech in front of a big crowd, and they love them, and people sort of get carried away. And often the conventions do feature a bump afterwards, but it almost always dissipates. So I'm not sure that part of the convention thing has been relevant for very long. Now,
part of the convention thing being convince people to vote for your candidate. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gives some attention to it, at least for a period of time, and then whatever was going to happen, it kind of settles back into what it was going to be anyway for all the reasons that people vote or not vote. This year, because it's more like a telethon or maybe an infomercial, I actually find it better in a lot of ways. It's 2 hours, tight production, just, you know, get the speeches on and some videos, have a little music, and then it's done without having to listen to the interminable talking heads in between going on and on, interpreting for me what I'm seeing. That part I do not miss at all. To me, you know, it loses the live energy, of course, but it also loses that. So I'm fine with that. And I felt like parts of the production that, you know, that we've seen up till now, the roll call I thought was actually more effective than usual.
Yes, I want to talk about that in a moment, but go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was pretty good. The speeches have been fine. I think the pandemic's been going on long enough that we're used to seeing people in their living rooms. It doesn't look jarring and weird as it might have 6 months ago to see this. So, you know, that isn't bothering me. And as to your point, of course, that what they've been trying to do, and again, we don't know what's happening in the next two nights, but we do know that they've featured an awful lot of Republicans in the first two nights. So clearly, they had made a decision that they thought, and I don't know if it's a matter of polling or whether it's a matter of, you know, Biden's instincts or just the party or whatever, that they're making a play for either Republican-leaning independents or my suspicion is it's those suburban white women think they may be able to secure by saying, look, the party's... You've always voted Republican, ladies, but we've got John Kasich and, I don't know, who did Colin Powell
and Susan Molinari, Christine Todd Whitman, Meg Whitman.
Right.
Go ahead.
These people, and they're here, you know, they're safe, and, you know, you don't have to worry. We're not going to, you know, everything will be fine. I mean, that's my sense that they're trying to do. Now, that, of course, is incredibly irksome to you and me, because we don't like those people and we're not really, you know, we don't really want the party to be defined by that. And we don't think it is defined by that, but it's clear to me that that's what they're looking for, is that there are some, what they're seeing somewhere in polling, I have to assume. And we're seeing it in the public polling too. It's very, very, these independent Republican leaners are leaning the other way pretty strongly, and white suburban women who have been coming over for a long time. I don't really think you needed Colin Powell and John Kasich to persuade those women, because they voted strongly in 2018. Look, I'm saying strongly like I'm Donald Trump. They voted heavily in 2018. I get it. I don't think it's going to have much effect one way or the other. I mean, you know, Biden, the spread has been pretty steady for quite some time. Everybody thinks it's going to tighten a bit. I don't think the convention's going to change that. For me, it is, to coin another Trump phrase, and I guess a Michelle Obama phrase, it is what it is. And, I don't feel like I want to get too upset about the lack of progressive representation, simply because, and maybe most importantly, because they did feature, Bernie, who gave a great speech, maybe the best one I've ever seen him give. It was really, really excellent. And, activists like Addie Barkin, who, that just breaks my heart. And when I see him there, it makes me, that's where I feel my progressive heart go, you know, when I see that kind of stuff. So I'm not unhappy or happy, but, you know, that's just me. I'm dead inside.
I think that's true, but I wonder if it, I think there is some analysis to be had of this, right? I mean, it certainly suggests that the Biden people feel that a sort of defensive posture is really the way to deal with this. I mean, it's quite possible that there is no implications to a convention, but it is, and if that's the case, it's still a projection of what the nominee thinks. And it could be, I think this is the best way for me to present myself to get those swing voters. It could be, I think that, like, I don't really need to do too much to keep the progressives, energized. The interesting thing about it is, the clear the we also get a very clear sense on how they are going to, and to a large extent, this has been the case, but, you know, this is really sort of theoretically the beginning of the general election. It's not like Joe Biden's up there pushing, you know, centrist policies. He's not pushing any policies.
Right.
No one said a word about policies except for Bernie Sanders, frankly, yeah. As far as I can tell. There are others who made, you know, some of the progressives made like sort of elliptical, elliptical references to things like health care, you know, that we might. But nothing I would call a policy in any way. It really is very much focused, and it probably makes sense. I mean, I don't know, you know, we can play a game like what would this convention have been and what would Biden's candidacy have been without Corona, but there's no point in doing that. There is a lot of focus, it seems to me, on just general competence and the notion that Joe Biden is a good guy. And I don't know if Joe Biden's a good guy or not, but I feel like they're doing a good job in making it seem like he is. And I think, you know, one thing that's clear coming out of this, right? I mean, I've watched, really, to me, what's most important is not even what happens at the convention, because the people watching the convention are probably the one cohort who have completely made up their minds.
Right.
I mean, I think it's either they're watching it because they hate these people or they're watching it because I'm going to vote for them.
Right.
But when you see like the second order stuff, like Chris Wallace on Fox News talk about how Michelle Obama was great, you know, FoxNews.com saying, you know, Kasich, former Republican, says he can't vote for Trump. I think that could be possibly helpful. Who knows, right? But I mean, that's interesting. At least they executed what their plan was well, which gives me a little bit of confidence going forward. I mean, there was something that was a little bit jumbled in 2016 and a little bit sort of, you know, Michael Bloomberg. Maybe it's also the format. I mean, nobody spoke for very long because, like you say, it just moves right through. And so nobody feels like they've gotten too much time and they in themselves can define anything. And maybe that sort of helps in terms of like, oh, here's a quick storyline that came out of it. But it's clear they are running a very defensive, or I should say non-aggressive campaign, which is really just like, I'm not an idiot. And I'm not an a-hole. Vote for me. And,
well, you know, it's not a bad,
I mean,
sticker in this day and age, honestly.
I mean, I think I think that might do
not
it.
An
I mean,
idiot the a-hole, yeah,
right.
For me.
But I mean, the interesting thing is too is that you, like, you know, you saw a series of things where people are saying, like, look, I don't agree with Biden, but I'm voting for him.
Yeah.
You know, and you see that from the left and for the right at the convention. And we are heading into a very different, if Joe Biden wins, it is not 2008. And
absolutely,
it is not going to be 2009.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is quite clear to me that, like, you know, people are just saying, like, you have until whatever it is, November 6th. You know, whatever the day is after the election, we'll give you Wednesday, maybe until noon, if you're declared the winner at that point. And then people are going to start organizing, I think. And there's going to be a real knockdown fight in the Democratic Party.
Don't you think that I mean, let's just talk for a moment about this AOC flap that happened after Tuesday night. She got up and she was asked by the Democratic Party, by the DNC, to, you know, second the nomination of Bernie Sanders, which made sense, you know, and she gave a, you know, a speech celebrating the movement that brought Bernie Sanders, you know, the number of votes that he did, and brought him to that convention with that many delegates. And she didn't really celebrate him as much as she celebrated this new, you know, progressive movement that sort of gathered around him, and frankly, I think is now sort of coalescing around her and some of the others that are in the process of taking over from Sanders as he, you know, becomes an elder statesman of that movement. It was a really good speech, but she did use all the sort of left-wing jargon. She was speaking to her people, you know, to her movement. She said things like colonialization and, you know, Islam and xenophobia, and she used words that, you know, suddenly got a bunch of people upset, going, well, she was just she wasn't speaking to the average person, which irritated the hell out of me, because this was specifically aimed at the people who voted for Bernie Sanders and who understood exactly what she was talking about.
It was aimed at people under the age of 40. Let's face it, it's aimed at people at the end of the age of 40.
This is the program, the platform, the progressive movement as it is, as she, you know, represents. So it was fine, and it was actually really good, and I didn't think a thing of it when I heard it. I went, oh, you know, AOC, she's really bringing it, you know, that's great. She's saying all the things that I think a lot of progressives want to hear coming out of the Democratic Party. Well, you know, after NBC ran something, you know, some nasty thing saying, you know, about how she had refused to, or that she didn't endorse Joe Biden. Well, of course not. She was nominating Bernie Sanders, and you don't endorse the other guy when you're doing that. It was ridiculous, and this is just the normal thing that you see at any convention. There was a big brouhaha. Hours later, NBC took it down and deleted that particular headline and that tweet. And AOC went on Instagram to talk about it a little bit, because it did become a big thing, and she was clearly irritated. But what she said was, the reason I bring it up is because it sort of follows on what you were saying, that, look, you know, we all want Joe Biden to be president. We all have reasons for wanting Joe Biden to be president. And first, she didn't say this, I'm paraphrasing her, but it was clear that she meant, look, we've got to get Donald Trump out of office. Joe Biden is the nominee. He's the head of the Democratic Party at the moment. We need to get him into office and get Donald Trump out. But we as a party have a whole lot of things that we care about, and these are the things that I care about and that the progressive movement cares about. And she was trying to explain, and I could tell she was a little bit irked. I think she did it late at night, you know, on her Instagram there. And Ness is exactly right. I mean, what the progressives, and I have to say, I am really proud of them. I'm proud of us for doing this, which is having the political maturity to understand that this election, we can't screw around, right? I mean, this is Donald Trump. He's proved that he's completely, you know, beyond acceptability. We have to get him out. And they have said, look, we'll be good soldiers here. We get it. We're going to do it. We're going to, you know, there's no Nader. There's no Jill Stein, whatever. We're going to do our thing here, and we're getting them in. But they are putting out plenty of warning signals that doesn't mean we're standing down, guys. All this means is that we're going to, you know, we're going to get Donald Trump out. And I think you're right. On the next day, you're going to have AOC. You're going to have a whole bunch of people, most of your listeners, most of my readers, that are going to go, okay, now we're going to stand up. We're not going to do what they did for Obama, which was, in my view, and I think yours too, we were very critical right out of the gate of the sort of centrist direction that Obama went in. You know, that's not going to happen this time.
Yep.
And I don't think, and Biden does not have the power to shut it down the way that Obama did.
Nope.
So, you know, it's a whole different dynamic.
I agree totally. And I would say, first of all, it's a whole different dynamic just because the outside structures are different, right? We have things like Justice Democrats. We have, you know, even back then, to the extent that there were any outside things, and many of them were in the veal pen, to borrow an old Fire Dog Lake term,
right?
They were dependent upon a very narrow set of donors, and that was, you know, that was 12 years ago. And there is a very different sort of, on the left, there is still the ability to raise significant amount of money by people who are not aligned with the establishment of the Democratic Party. And I'll say this is complete speculation on my part and conjecture, But I don't think NBC just sort of made that up. I think there were, and I would imagine there were members of the Democratic Party who were looking to cast AOC as if she is a troublemaker within the party, because there's a lot of people, I think, realize that she very well could be the future. And they don't necessarily want that future. And I would also be I would not be surprised if AOC was happy to take that position, you know, that speaking role, because it did mean that she didn't have to do a full throated, you know, unequivocal and 60-second endorsement of Joe Biden. And so, you know, it worked as it worked, although I do get the sense that maybe she was annoyed, not just that because she was probably aware on some level that this is somebody sort of set that up, that that tact, because that what we saw her do happens at every single convention, and you never hear about it because it's somebody sitting on a floor and they're not a prominent person and blah, blah, blah. And this was, you know, that type of stuff that I got no problem with it insofar as that it just reminds the left that, like, you know, unlike with Obama, it is not Betty Bye time. If Joe Biden wins, it is time to redouble efforts, because the reality is that Joe Biden will feel the pressure a lot more than Donald Trump will. And so there's even more reason to fight hard in this situation. So let's move to a another topic briefly, and that is the Postal Service. Speaking of pressure, we have seen over the past couple of days DeJoy, the Postmaster General, at least back off some of the cuts that he was implementing. Ostensibly because the post office is financially hurting and needs to have these cuts. But, you know, there's this sort of like almost counter narrative that's forming, where people are saying, like, well, I mean, you know, this is just incompetence and blah, blah, blah. And I think there's a lot of incompetence here. There is a lot of Republican ideology looking to privatize the post office. But we also have a president who's fundamentally terrified of vote by mail. And wants to sink it. And it's there's a real quality to all this of, like, Paul Wolfowitz going in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and saying, you know, weapons of mass destruction is what we could all settle on. And because you have a bunch of different agendas that are aligned, they may be, their motivations may be different. But every single part of the, you know, the sort of the apparatus from the administration and from the Board of Governors and from the Postmaster General is, let's screw with the Postal Service, period, end of story. And what's been interesting is that, and it's a real testament to the power of a universal service, that I think the reason why DeJoy backed off and why Mitch McConnell is saying maybe there's a room for some negotiation with the Save the Postal Bill is because it's not because they want to be reasonable. It's because their voters in rural areas are going, hey, wait a second. That tractor part I ordered is taking too long to get here. The chickens I ordered are taking too long to get here. The vets are saying the medication that I rely on via the post office is not getting to me. And so they're getting pressure now, and this is universal pressure, and it sets up a situation with the Democrats that, man, oh, man, I hope they don't blow this.
Oh, God. You know, I'm terrified that they will, and I'm hopeful that they won't, because it's exactly what you say. The idea that this universal service, and it affects every single person almost every day, and it affects us at a time when we've never been more dependent on the post office. I mean, I don't know about you, but since the pandemic hit, I'm ordering a lot more stuff to be delivered to me than I ever did before. I mean, it's just natural, right? I mean, if I can save myself having to go out and be among people someplace, I tend to do it now. And I think, you know, tons of people are doing that, and plenty of Trump voters are doing it too. And I can testify to the fact that in the last month and a half, everything has just suddenly gotten way less reliable with the post office. And things that I order aren't coming. They've been stuck. And, you know, you can track all this stuff now. Maybe Trump doesn't know that, but you can track it. Now, he may think that he has had this clever thing where he's proving that the post office isn't reliable for your vote, so you can't vote by mail. So all you Democrats stay home, right? That seems to be his strategy. But it proves something completely different. A, that the post office was actually a very reliable service that we all value, and people were reminded of that, and that Trump himself has come in there. It's under his auspices, and everybody knows it, that he has thrown a monkey wrench into the whole thing in order to, you know, help him win re-election. And also, you know, maybe privatize it or do whatever. But whatever he, the big efficient businessman and his flunky who he put in there, this big donor who supposedly knows about logistics, whatever they did made it way worse. I mean, I've never seen a better illustration of Republican, you know, the idea that we should run the government like a business. I've never seen a better illustration of how that is completely fatuous and a ridiculous thing. The post office ran fine until the big business guys decided to get involved and make it, quote, better. So I think this is a big, I think it's one of his biggest mistakes. And, it, you know, I, again, I'm with you. I'm fingers crossed that the Democrats don't mess this up.
And by mess it up, by mess it up, I want to be clear here. The Republicans are coming in for a short-term bill to maybe extend unemployment benefits a little bit, to maybe extend the PPP a little bit, and maybe to throw a little bit of money at the post office. And the idea, the danger here with that type of bill is if they're coming to the table because they're getting pressure about the post office, people have to remember the reporting was a couple of months ago that the Republicans in the Senate in particular, but broadly speaking, the party is going to wait and see where Donald Trump is after Labor Day. And that's when you'll start to see them cut bait. Now, none of them are going to cut bait in a public way. They're going to cut bait in a way that they start to think like, OK, wait a second. Joe Biden may be president. So if the Democrats are under the illusion that they can take a they can put some salve on the friction that the Republicans are getting from their own voters right now, and that 3 weeks later the Republicans will come back and negotiate to deal with stuff like financing for cities and states, they are insane. Nancy Pelosi has learned this lesson. Well, I shouldn't say that she's learned it. Nancy Pelosi was basically taught this lesson once, which is you need to get what you can when you have leverage, because if you give the Republicans what they want, they will not come back to the table. They don't care about cities. They don't care about states. They don't care about hospitals. They don't care about extending the unemployment benefits of people for the most part. Maybe the last one they're a little more sensitive to because people feel it right away. But you and I, we mentioned this last week. If Nancy Pelosi makes a deal with Mitch McConnell without getting city and state this round, this go round, it's not happening, because the fiscal cliff for states and cities happens in October.
Right.
And by the time, you know, and if they're under the impression, the Republicans, that that Donald Trump is not going to win, they are more than willing to allow cities and states to sink the economy. There's just like, it's so obvious. Nancy Pelosi said in April that they were going to get the city and the state funding done. Well, now it's August and it still hasn't happened because the Republicans do not care. And they're going to come, and when they come to the table, it's because they're getting pressure about something that they're going to deliver anyways.
Right.
So $10 billion for the post office is not a gift to the Democrats or the post office. It is a Republican want. And when Mitch McConnell says there's something in the postal bill that we can negotiate with, everybody, you know, lock up your cash,
right.
Hide your money.
Watch your wallet. Yeah.
Watch your wallet. And we'll see if Pelosi and Schumer, fall for this again. I mean, boy, oh boy. I mean,
well,
I don't even know what to say about it. I'm terrified.
Keep in mind that Trump retweeted somebody this week who said, "Democrat cities, let them rot." And, you know, that's what Trump retweeted. So, you know, we know where he stands on this. And he's in until January. If they let cities and states go belly up in October, as you say, when they think, by January, I don't even know what Joe Biden will have to deal with. By that time, I mean, things will fall apart very, very quickly. This isn't something you can just paper over because they're strained already, right? I mean, this has been 6 months now of terrible strain on all the budgets with no money going to stay. I mean, Cuomo, you know, I mean, we can talk about him another time if you want. But, you know, for all of his flaws, one of the things he was saying all the way back in the spring, in April and May, every day when he was droning on at his coronavirus briefings, was saying, we have to have money for the states and cities. We will not be able to sustain this. We can't sustain this. So this has been going on a long time. And, and this is not something when it falls, let's just put it this way. It's going slowly at first, and then when it falls apart, it will fall apart all at once. And fixing it in February is going to be a monstrous task. They can't screw around with this. They just can't.
I agree with you. All right, lastly, let's just talk about this Senate Intel report that was released.
Yeah.
It was a report that was chaired by a Republican. The report goes further than the Mueller. Remember, they don't have to prove anything criminally, and they can actually come to some conclusions, whereas Mueller felt like he couldn't. This report basically says that Paul Manafort was aware that his, what would you call it, his benefactor, Kalimnik, this Russian oligarch, was also a spy. And that Kalimnik was the one that Manafort gave the campaign information to, that Manafort had, at the very least, a lot of reason to believe that Kalimnik was a spy. But some of the transcripts they found of conversations indicated that Manafort knew that he couldn't, at least at one point prior to the campaign in his past dealings with him, that he couldn't allow him to hear sensitive information that maybe you wouldn't want the Russians to hear. And then we have more report. The report also talks about Donald Trump clearly conspired with Stone, who was in contact with WikiLeaks to release information that had been hacked and leaked. They participated in that. Kalimnik himself may have also participated in the hack.
That's right. And they think that Manafort knew that there is evidence in there, which they were not entirely able to confirm, but looks pretty strong, that Manafort knew that Kalimnik was involved in what they call the hack and leak program, which was the biggie, right? The one where they stole all the emails and then released them. And then the second part was that Roger Stone was involved in giving direction to WikiLeaks to release those emails at specific times, in one specific time when the Access Hollywood tape came out, that he actually made a call and the emails were released within half an hour. This is big, Sam, because what it says is, first of all, there was definitely collusion. The idea that there was no collusion is ridiculous. The campaign chairman of the Trump campaign was...
Well, Let me just say this about the word collusion, okay? There is no crime collusion. And the report doesn't say the word collusion. But here is the example that I use. Did I contact you, Heather, for this conversation that we're having today? The answer is no. My producer, Scott, books you every week because we've decided, Scott knows that I don't even say to Scott, book Heather. Scott knows that I want to book Heather. Scott books Heather. Heather shows up. We're here. There is aligned interest. Everybody knows what's expected of them, and they go ahead. Have we colluded to have you on the show? Well, I didn't call you. I didn't tell Scott to call you. But here you are. And so, you know, this is the thing, that the semantics of the whole collusion thing, the bottom line is Donald Trump, through different conduits, solicited help. What that help was, he didn't direct it. He didn't say, go into these servers and hack. And the Russians didn't say, like, would you like some emails? The Russians, you know, like, they both had an interest. They were aware of it. They did as much as they could without getting too deeply involved in helping and enabling each other to do this stuff. Whether it was like, hey, there's a tape coming out where I talk about grabbing someone's, vagina. Now would be a good time to release what you got. I mean, and look, I don't know. Would the Comey letter could have been more relevant than this stuff. Not campaigning in Wisconsin and not doing enough polling there could have been more relevant than this stuff. We don't know. But the Comey letter was a breach of policy that he's had to take responsibility for. The failure of the polling in Wisconsin is not illegal. And, you know, I think it's quite apparent that there was, you know, flaws in the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. I don't think it's as ideological as some might contend. And I think some of it might have to do with gender. Some might be just her personal brand. But the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump, a candidate, solicited help from an outside entity, a foreign country in this instance. I mean, if he had got this from Boeing, for instance, and Boeing broke into hacked into the emails of the Clinton campaign, and Boeing didn't have direct contact. I mean, I would be outraged. I would be outraged.
Of course, and
I don't see why there's any different.
He turned around and did it again with the Ukrainian president. I mean, he released the transcript of the phone call in which he directly solicited the help of a foreign entity in his political campaign. I mean, that was obvious. And, you know, I think it's really, really interesting, though, that Mueller apparently, Andrew Weissman, the lawyer that actually prosecuted Manafort, did not know until this report that there was evidence that Kilimnik was actually involved in the hack and leak, and that Manafort may have known that. Now, he probably suspected it. They had a lot of information around that, apparently, and a lot of this is redacted even in the Senate report. But this is very interesting. It says a lot about Mueller and the limitations of that investigation and how we sadly put way, way, way too much hope in a Republican investigator under a Department of Justice run by a bunch of Republicans. That was a foolish thing that we did. But this report, interestingly, because the Senate, for whatever reason, Burr was, you know, maybe they just decided, hey, you know, maybe I kind of want to be on the right side of history on this one. I don't know. Maybe it was kind of finessed by Mark Warner. Maybe he managed to do that in a way that most of the politicians involved in this whole thing were unable to do. But that is very, very interesting information. The chairman of a political campaign was directly involved with what apparently was a Russian agent, Konstantin Kilimnik, which they determined was a Russian agent, and he was giving them inside information on the campaign, polling information. Now, why would you do that? Because they were targeting. They were targeting certain places. Now, this is about as, I mean, it's traitorous. It's just traitorous. It just is. There's no other way to put it. I mean, it's not technically treason, but I mean, this is an absolutely astonishing thing for a political campaign to have done. And this guy wasn't just some, you know, Carter Page guy, some, you know, weirdo on the fringe. He was the chairman of the political campaign during those months. It is a shocking revelation. And, you know, I think the reverberations of this are going to go for a long, long time. You have Marco Rubio came out. He's the new chairman since Burr had to step down since he's a crook. And he came out and said, it just proves that there's no collusion. It says nothing of the kind. You know, again, your semantic, you know, discussion there is relevant. But those people on those Republicans, which include Rubio, Cornyn, a whole bunch of them, they all knew what Trump was. They knew that at best he was an absolute idiot who had no business being anywhere near the power of the presidency. They voted to acquit him for doing something almost exactly the same as what they did in 2016. What he did with the Ukrainian president is no different than what Manafort was doing with what his campaign chairman did in 2016. They acquitted him anyway. They did it. It's on them. It is on them. I mean, they should never be allowed to forget that. And when, you know, this is something that I think is going to reverberate through the Republican Party for a long time. I mean, a lot of stuff is. But this in particular is a truly stunning, you know, development, really.
Well, from your mouth, Heather, like Digby said. Heather, as always, a pleasure. I'm off on vacation. So the Farron will be here next week. But thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Enjoy your time off. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers who converted into members and supporters of this show. I cannot thank you enough. And if you're listening to the free podcast, consider to become a member and supporter over at ROFpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow Ring of Fire on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more and check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm, my daily live stream covering all the big news stories of the day. This week, we have all new pre-recorded interviews, some fascinating stuff. Check it out. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire. You can-